You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 2nd to the 8th of November 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, reporter Ellie Bothwell and deputy features editor Jack Grove. As Chancellor of the University of California, Berkeley, Nicholas Dirks had to endure protests from both sides of the political spectrum and even a threat from US President Donald Trump, who threatened to take away the university's funding. He's been talking to John Gill about his 4 years in charge of Berkeley, a tenure which came to an end earlier this year. And Jack Grove has been in Paris. He's written about the return of Paris's most celebrated institution, the Sorbonne, some 50 years after it was dismantled. But first, John, to you. You've been speaking to Nicholas Dirks, Chancellor of Berkeley. The interview billed on the front page as a talk about the battle for the soul of US higher education. Is it soul under threat?
Yeah, and I don't think that's an exaggeration in the sense that Berkeley is the most iconic public university in the US, the sort of spiritual home of free speech, obviously from its the 1960s heyday of the process there. And I think what we've seen in Berkeley over the last few years, I mean, there's a whole host of issues that affect Berkeley and indeed the other great public institutions in the US, funding being a very obvious one of them, because state funding for higher education has declined very dramatically over recent years. Mm. In fact, I think in the interview, Nick Dirks does give some figures behind it and says that the proportion of Berkeley's funding that comes from the state is now somewhere around the 10% figure, where it was up to a third not only a few years ago. So there's been a real issue there. But beyond that, freedom of speech and the sort of culture wars that are going on in the US and indeed crossing the Atlantic and taking place here in the UK to a certain extent now feature very highly within that. Nick Dirks obviously had a whole series of issues while he was at Berkeley that he had to deal with, not least the attempt by Milo Yiannopoulos to give a talk on campus in February of this year, which eventually had to be abandoned when about 100 or 150, I should say, masked protesters dressed in black stormed onto the campus, arriving without any trace on social media or any forewarning that they were going to arrive, and causing chaos to the point that the very expensively assembled security forces on campus, the police that had been drafted in to make sure that the event could take place, decided it wasn't safe for it to do so and cancelled the event, which then precipitated this series of events, including a tweet from Donald Trump threatening to remove federal funding from Berkeley. But what Nick really gets into in the interview is that, well, a few things. One, that it's very troubling to him that actually some of the attempts to shut down free speech in that way are coming from groups that ostensibly at least claim to be on the left. And another is the political interference in free speech. He cites a series of law changes that have either taken place or are being debated in about 14 US states, stemming from right-wing think tanks which are really arguing for free speech to be protected by law, which at face value sounds great, but when you get into the detail, what they're really talking about is for legal authorities to actually involve themselves in university affairs and, for example, adjudicate on whether a university president is saying something that is too politically inflected. Well, as Nick Dirks says in his piece, almost everything a university president says around an issue such as widening participation will have some political inflection. So to have the threat of disciplinary action hanging over them coming from the legislature, and you know, coming primarily from a right-wing pressure group that are really pushing these laws is deeply problematic, not just for the universities involved, but for free speech and democracy as we know it. And clearly some of these issues are now starting to play out in slightly different ways and probably slightly less worrying ways, but nevertheless playing out here in the UK as well. So really, really interesting. Lots of ground covered, and clearly a 3 or 4 year tenure for Nick Dirks that was extraordinarily eventful. So lots to read about and lots to get into there.
Indeed, yeah, you describe it as a feeding frenzy, in fact. One other quick story I will touch on there is sort of members of his own faculty in many cases going to the press a lot, and either them or others sort of peddling stories to the local media. One about the cost of the fence around his own residence, another about the construction of an escape hatch in his office, which actually turned out to be a door. But, you know, a very tumultuous 4 years, and really does sort of bring to the fore the challenges of being at the head of one of the sort of world's best-known institutions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's an iconic institution. He clearly has been there at a very, very tricky time, trying to sort of hold it together. And I think, it's, to return to where we started, this idea of the soul of US higher education. US higher education is incredibly stratified. You know, the elites in the Ivy League are at one end. One of the statistics that comes out in here is that Berkeley has, I think it was something like, it has more students with Pell Grants, which is the federal funding for less affluent students, than the entire Ivy League put together. I mean, it's really extraordinary the extent to which the public still carry a huge weight for, you know, raising aspirations, widening participation, social mobility, and all those things. So it's really, really important that these institutions survive, and that's the story of the piece, really.
Yeah, a challenge as well, sort of balancing those local responsibilities with those sort of needs to be a globally known institution with a reputation for world-class research. We could talk about it for much more. It's all in that feature in the magazine, and of course on timeshighereducation.com as well. Moving to the news section now, Ellie. Universities across the world, you write this week, under increasing pressure to break their ties with institutions in Myanmar. We've all heard about the country's military crackdown on Rohingya Muslims. It's a big issue, and one that you've been looking into this week.
Yes. I mean, there are two sort of main lines of thought on this, really. One is that, you know, universities in, say, you know, the UK and the US and Australia, you know, many of which have got ties with universities in Myanmar, should, you know, break those ties immediately, because, you know, some academics claim that these universities, you know, can't be considered independent from the regime over there, that you know, universities in the Western world need to kind of make a stand and boycott the country altogether. Mm. And then there's a kind of second line of thought, which is, well, actually, you know, education is the only way in which to, you know, stop this crisis from continuing. And actually, you know, higher education in Myanmar is just starting to kind of open up again. And, you know, they need their kind of academic partners in other parts of the world more than ever.
Yeah.
So, those are the two sort of main arguments really presented in the story.
Indeed. Always the issue that raises its head really about boycotts, isn't it? We've seen it with Israel as well. If universities can't form partnerships and discussions and work together, regardless of political situations, then I guess who can?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult debate because I guess it centres on whether the universities can be considered independent from the regime. So I spoke to Penny Green, who's a professor at Queen Mary, and she, you know, she was just adamant that you know, universities just couldn't work with the country at all. She said it's unconscionable for us to have any dealings with the government and military, and she thought that working with universities there would result in that, whereas, you know, others I spoke to actually said they thought that institutions over there weren't actually sort of that related to the regime, you know, that actually they were able to still be independent.
I think that's crucial, isn't it? The idea of, and it does vary country to country, the extent to which universities are independent, autonomous, you know, academic institutions versus to the extent to which they're arms of the state. you know, the question that I suppose we're posing in this piece is, where on the spectrum do they sit within Myanmar? And that really is the crux of the issue. And there do seem to be quite different perspectives on that from the experts that we've looked at within the piece. But really interesting, because it applies to, as you say, Chris, it's an issue that comes up at any time there's a, you know, a human crisis or a situation where a government is behaving in an authoritarian way, the extent to which universities are responsible for that or can be sort of part of any boycott that takes place.
Indeed.
But this isn't really just about the crisis and the atrocities. Myanmar's is routinely judged as one of the most corrupt governments in the world. This is not a surprise. It's in Asia, it's always considered the most corrupt country. And so when you know that, should you really be getting into bed with these people, given that atrocities that we've seen are just sort of the latest incarnations.
The question's the same, though, isn't it? When you say getting into bed with these people, who are these people you're getting into bed with? Are they independent academic institutions, or are they so closely affiliated to the state and controlled by the state that actually, you know, but they themselves bear some responsibility for the corruption that goes on?
But then you'd have to go on a case-by-case basis of each individual project, each individual person, who you're working with at what time. Isn't the first step to say, okay, well, let's take a step back now and reassess?
I don't know that you would have. I mean, I think, you know, when you look at sectors, it's very clear that institutional autonomy, and this stuff is indexed, isn't it, by organisations, institutions in the UK are very independent, separate from the state, etc., the way they're set up and so on. If you go to other countries, that's not the case. Even in, you know, countries that aren't unsavoury in any way, if you go to some continental European countries, they're much more part of the state and so on. So I think you can take, I have to admit, you know, I don't know enough about the structure of Myanmar myself to take a personal view on that, but clearly the view from the academic experts we speak to in the piece, there are some quite different points of view on this. It doesn't seem to be very clear cut, judging from the quotes that Ellie has in her news story.
Indeed. Well, you can read that news story on page 6 and 7 of the magazine, and of course on the website too. Now, you mentioned continental Europe there. Jack, you've been over in Paris talking about the great return of the year. Forget Liam Gallagher or Pink. The comeback is all about the Sorbonne.
Yes, well, John was talking about iconic institutions, and they don't really come more iconic than the Sorbonne, because for many years this was really the preeminent university of the world, and Paris was the intellectual and scientific capital of the world, and Sorbonne was very much at the heart of that. But it was more or less sort of shut down in 1968 to 1970 following quite violent student protests. And it was split into 13 different institutions, which have all done relatively okay over the years, but none have the same name recognition as the Sorbonne.
And well, have ridiculous names, don't they?
Paris 4. Paris 4, Paris 7, Paris 9. You know, they don't really sort of ring out in the same way as the Sorbonne. So from January, two of the top universities, one a scientific one, one specialising in arts and humanities, are going to merge, and it's going to be a proper sort of re-establishment of the comprehensive university, which it seems that many sectors are seeing this is now the way forward. So the Sorbonne is actually going to come back in a proper way, and you know, within a few years it might be in the top 100, top 50 perhaps for the world. And you know, it could be a force to be reckoned with.
Indeed. So it's a merger, isn't it, of UPMC and Paris Sorbonne University, or Paris 4, which will take place in January. And is it the rankings, do you think, that's partly to do with sort of driving this desire to be recognised internationally? Because historically they don't do too well on world university rankings because of their sort of granular nature.
Yeah, France does really quite badly on the rankings. You know, the Sorbonne would hopefully change that for France. But it's not just about ranking, it's also about being able to offer more interdisciplinary courses. It's being able to attract international students with a bit of name recognition. It's also sort of embracing Paris and the identity of Paris a bit more, rather than trying to have this rather sort of clinical name of Paris 4 or Paris 2, or invent names like the Pierre and Marie Curie University, which is quite a sort of mouthful, really.
And UPMC has it. Yeah.
And it's so things like that. They've tried them, but they're really recognising that the Sorbonne is a great brand for them, and they want to sort of revive it.
Yeah, not the only one in France, of course, coming about as a result of mergers. Paris Sciences Lettres as well. I know you were writing about recently too.
A bit
of a trend.
This is a trend, but this is perhaps a more deeper merger than PSL. This is two universities really, you know, throwing their lot in together, whereas those are a more sort of looser coalition of universities.
Indeed. Well, you can read about all those stories that we've discussed today on timeshighereducation.com. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook and on LinkedIn as well if you want to join the conversation there. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.